this is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu on Books. Our guest today is Ghazala Wahab, whose recently released book, Born a Muslim, Some Truths About Islam in India, has created quite a stir, particularly in our present times when our reputation as a secular state is getting trampled. In contemporary politics, the debates and discussions around Hindus and Muslims are getting vitriolic and polarized and at the same time becoming more relevant. Ghazala, who is the executive editor of the Force News magazine, says, as a journalist, her writings have always been about national security, terrorism and insurgency, refugees and displaced people. Islam is her faith and was never her work of writing. But this book, which is her solo, was born out of her personal experiences and perhaps as a necessity in the India we live in today, where hate is getting normalized. In some parts of the country, if a Muslim tenant is rejected, somewhere else, a Muslim delivery boy is not accepted. How did we get into such a situation? And is there a hope of getting out ever? Ghazala demystifies it all in her book and is here with us to share her thoughts. A very warm welcome to you, Ghazala.
Thank you so much, Shoma.
So let me start directly by asking one simple question. Like, do you think that Islam is more misunderstood than ever before in this new India now? And why I'm asking this is because, you know, generally the understanding of Islam in the context of Indian history has always been a little complicated and even twisted, if I may say so.
I agree with the last sentence that you have said. Our understanding is twisted. And this is the reason why I disagree with the first part, which is that it is misunderstood. I think it was never misunderstood in India traditionally, but in the last century, there was a deliberate attempt to mislead and misinterpret Islam so that it could be vilified for a common person. This is a deliberate thing that has happened in the last one century. So to say that it is misunderstood today is not entirely correct. People misunderstand it because they have chosen not to understand it as their ancestors probably did. As I have written in the book, the growth of Islam in India, it's spread throughout the country and its equation with the people, native people of India who were already here and were pursuing various religions, Hinduism being one of them. It was very organic. It happened in a very natural manner. There was nothing which was artificial of in this development or in this spread of Islam in India. Though there were some element of force involved in certain parts of the country, but my position and my understanding is that you cannot force a person to change that person's religion. A person under duress can pretend to be somebody else. But religion is such an intrinsic part of your personality. You know, your entire being, for a religious person, your entire being hinges on your faith because your afterlife depends on your faith. So if somebody forces you to change your faith, how can you do that? I mean, you cannot jeopardize your afterlife because somebody is forcing you in this life. So I do not agree with this that it was entirely by sword that Islam was spread. And because of that, now suddenly there's an awakening and people are, you know, there's a pushback against Islam in India as a very natural corollary of the fact that it was forced. So I do not agree with this. The other thing that I feel, I'm not talking about how Islam spread right now, I'm just answering the in the present context. What is happening is, our patience with understanding things is very limited. With this preponderance of social media and personal media like WhatsApp and earlier you had emails like, you know, personal email ID, where people would forward mails to friends or, you know, a vast group of people. All this facilitated spread of wrong, false information. And because not many people bother to verify everything they get on a forward, whether it was an email forward or a WhatsApp forward. So they started believing whatever they received. And it's easy to falsify things and just attribute things to somebody. I mean, we see it all the time. I don't know how familiar you are with poetry. Any verse is passed off as Mirza Ghalib's verse, or poet Gulzar actually clarified saying that 80% verses which are circulating on social media attributed to me have not been written by me.
Right.
So nobody bothers.
Yeah. It is even the more dangerous part is the faster dissemination.
Yes.
And the blind faith.
Because people do not bother to verify or check anything. Even yesterday on my housing society WhatsApp group, a completely nonsense thing was passed as some doctor, a false name was attributed to somebody and said this doctor was talking to so-and-so and this doctor has said this. No, no such doctor exists in no such hospital. But people just keep forwarding these things without taking the responsibility of what they're forwarding.
Right. So about your book, you know, I found that it was, you're very beautifully and carefully worded it. You know, there's a lot of sensitivity in it. There is empathy. Your research on the history and evolution of Islam is also very enriching. Then, of course, your personal memories, which is like you start your book with the first 40, 45 pages. They really hit you. They are really horrifying. Then your criticism of the Muslim leadership and the clergy is also very bold and scathing. So when did all this, you know, actually start, when did you start conceptualizing that you wanted to write this book, and for how many years do you work on this book?
Actually, I conceptualized it in a very rapid fashion. I don't know how it happened so quickly, but after my first book, which I had co-authored with my colleague, it was a book on China. It came out in 2017. So after that, I was thinking about writing a book again, you know, on my a solo book. So I was debating with 2-3 subjects in my mind, and I had mentioned a few subjects to my publisher, and I was not thinking that they would immediately latch onto the Islam subject. So Islam was one of the subjects which I had mentioned. Even I didn't have too much of clarity about what I wanted to write, but I just thought that I would write a book addressing Muslims, and I would base it largely on my own experience. And I'll tell them that, look, this is also a kind of Islam we have in India. And my family is not a unique, it's not unique in the way it has been practicing the religion. A vast number of Muslims in India practice it the way we do. I mean, this was my understanding with all the people I used to meet and Muslims that I met. They were more or less like me. So that was my original idea. But once we started talking about it, then I decided to, you know, get a little bit more, because publishers are very difficult to please. And they kept saying, why do you say this? What is the basis of your, writing this argument, or why are you pointing this out? That led to some research. So this whole process of finally getting a proposal approved itself took me about 6 months thereafter, because I had to then do a lot of research. I did a few preliminary interviews also, only to write the proposal, because I realized that I didn't know much about the subject, and I didn't know much about claims that I was making, because things that I was saying was basically hearsay, things that I had heard at home. I had no evidence to actually, you know, prove that this is how it was. So that is where the conceptualization took about 6 months, and the first draft took nearly a year for me to write. And then they decided that the book had more potential than all of us had anticipated. So then they asked me to, add some 50,000 words more, and include the present I was not writing about the victimization of Muslims. In my original manuscript, it was not there because I was talking more of history and I was talking of future. I had kind of jumped the present time completely. I had not mentioned the communal violence or love jihad or lynching or any of this. But then they said, no, we can't, if you're doing a book, then we can't overlook this aspect. So you include this.
Okay. So would you be kind of, do you think that you have presented your book as a, what should I say, as an antidote to this rising communalism? Again, we come to the present times only, you know, because maybe the publication is at quite an appropriate time for at least all the thinking people, you know, who can think righteously.
Yes, and I think for that, I have to thank my publishers to have the foresight to see that for a book to be relevant to its time, you cannot ignore the present. So that they asked me to do this and I did it the way I did. So I think it was very, very opportune that it has come out at this time. And it is drawing people, or at least from the feedback that I have got, it is actually compelling a lot of people to ask questions and talk about it. So that's the first part of starting a conversation. And I think this is a very, I'm grateful for all this that is happening, all the attention that the book is getting and the kind of response that I'm getting from the readers.
Right, because you also have talked about, you want to address both the Muslims and the non-Muslims, and you want to build a bridge of conversation through this book. And I think this book is actually fulfilling that purpose, right?
Absolutely. And I'm really surprised that I have got no backlash from any Muslim, even the conservative Muslims. Some of them have very politely said, we don't agree with everything. But it's a very good argument that you have presented. It's a very good book or things like that. So I'm the publishers also were very worried. I mean, they ran the manuscript through some religious people and were lawyers to see if there are issues which could, get either of us in trouble. But I was a little cautious about the fact that maybe some Muslim ulama may find elements in it. Because I'm not a Muslim scholar, I'm not a qualified scholar of Islam who could be writing on religious matters. And I have written extensively on religious matters. I have written on the Quran and I have written about the Hadith. And since you are not a Muslim, you wouldn't understand the importance of Hadith for an average Muslim. They refer to Hadith as basically a historical document of, Prophet's life and early years of Islam. So for a lot of Muslims, Hadith is as sacred as the Quran itself. But I have, stuck my neck out and I have said that it should not be regarded as sacred as the Quran. And anything written in the Hadith should not be taken as seriously as you take the Quran. There's a distinction you have to make between these two texts. So I was worried that some Muslims may object to this, but thankfully that has not happened. So this part of my audience is apparently happy.
But it is just this environment, the inclusion of the word Muslim. I think that kind of triggers all kinds of emotions and cautions.
Yes, you're right. And I realized that a lot of people are getting back at me without even having read the book. And they are talking about the strangest things, which has nothing to do with what I have written. But the very fact that I am saying that, look at the Muslims, they are in such a bad, a pitiable state in India. All Muslims have been victim of deliberate vilification. This itself just angers a certain group of people and they start lashing out. So I suppose it's the atmosphere that we have built for ourselves in the last few years, where you have no patience to even bother to check what a person has said or written. You just have to immediately lash out.
Right. So like all the events, like you have also looked at, like from this 1980 Moradabad Eidgah killings, then Advani's Rath Yatra, followed by the riots, then the demolition of Babri Masjid, to the last year's Delhi riots following the protests against the CA and NRC. So each event has kind of always played into the psyche of, say, average mind of Muslims, average Muslim families, including yours. So can you just a little bit elaborate on how the behavior of these law enforcing agencies, they have always added to the vulnerability of the Muslims?
You know, a lot of people say that even the law enforcement agencies, they are product of our society. I do not agree entirely with this. I think more than that, they're subservient to orders that are given to them. So if you have a good or a righteous leadership at the top, then everybody falls in line and obeys that sort of an order. But if you have a compromised leadership at the top, then everybody, all the foot soldiers, they become compromised. And unfortunately, in India, we've had, and I have written about this in my earlier writings also, when I've written on counterterrorism or when I've written on, you know, other issues. We have a concept of a few hour syndrome, in which the government, it's probably not the government, but certain elements within the government machinery or the bureaucracy, they allow the lawbreakers or the rioters or the violators a margin or a cushion of a few hours to vent their anger, to do whatever they want before the law enforcement agencies swing into action and, you know, they try and stop them. And this has happened in riot after riot after the partition. What the reason could be behind this beyond communalization, I don't know. Either are they driven by communal feeling or sentiment, or they think that, you know, like an old saying that if the milk is on a boil, then you just let it boil over, then it calms down. So is it that, or I mean, what could be the logic for this? I don't know. But this has happened, and I do not think it is entirely because they are highly communal. Maybe some element within the law enforcement agencies would be highly communal, but not all of them. See, if you have a leader, I remember I keep giving this example of this, you know, DG police of Punjab. So, and even today, he has this reputation of being extremely upright person. So during his tenure, you didn't hear about these extrajudicial killings or anything. I mean, things changed when Gill took over. And to Gill, the credit of wiping out the terrorism from Punjab goes. But this, how can I forget his name? Ribeiro.
Ribeiro.
So it was the same police, but it depended upon who the leadership was. So I feel to a very large extent, the leadership matters. If you see even the Gujarat riots of 2002, wherever you had good leaders, you know, the good honorable IPS officers or non-compromised IPS officers, they were able to control the mob. But wherever they did want to control the mob, they didn't. Either they came late or they stood by, or as we saw in Delhi riots last year, they stood by. They were not trying to control the mob for various reasons. I mean, also many videos have come out. But whenever they wanted to control the mob, they did manage to control the mob. When the attack on JNU happened, they didn't control the mob. They were standing there, and videos came out on social media that how the people who had attacked the JNU last year, they coolly walked out. Some faces were shown, and you know, it's all in public domain. So if the law enforcement agencies want to act, they can act. So I think everything eventually depends upon who, what sort of a leadership you have.
When we talk about, you know, the fear and the confusion of an average Muslim, On the other side of the spectrum, if we look at the average Hindu, so their perception of radicalized Islam is kind of, you know, majority will find is based on the partition horror or the exodus of Kashmiri Pandits. And what happens is religion, instead of professing peace, it incites violence. So what do you have to say, you know, how do we kind of juxtapose the two sides?
You know, the irony of religion, any religion, is that it is supposed to give you peace. It is supposed to put some sort of order in your life. Yet it is also capable of arousing the most violent and the most base instincts in a human being. Throughout history, the call of religion has actually killed more people than any, non-religious calls have also killed people, but from crusades to even before that, when you had the Jewish and the, you know, the pagans of that period, they were fighting among themselves. So the religion, then Christians and Muslims were fighting, and then now in India we see this Hindu and Muslim. So religion has been capable of arousing really violent reactions among people. But as far as the Hindu thinking or Hindu perception of Islam as a violent religion is concerned, I think the post-partition memories of people, it created a fertile ground in which propaganda could be nurtured. Even Muslims suffered during the partition. People who were going from India to Pakistan, a lot of manslaughter was happening even among them. So these are memories which people have held on to across communities, whether it's Hindus or Sikhs or Muslims. So it created this kind of I wouldn't say hatred, but this kind of a
hostility.
I don't know if it's really hostility also, because I know a lot of people who have survived the violence of partition, and they are not hostile to the other community. I mean, I have not only in India, but even in Pakistan, I have come across people who actually do not bear any ill will to who they thought were attacking them or who they thought were their violators, because they understand or they have been able to put it in the context that those were unnatural circumstances and the times were such that people were driven by this complete hatred against each other for various reasons. So a lot of Hindus, I know so many Hindus whose families have suffered during partition, but they are the most amicable people. They have and probably because of their history of living with Muslims in Lahore or in other parts of Pakistan, they still are friends with a lot of Muslims in India. They find some kind of, some kind of commonality of language or shared experience in food or whatever. So they do not live with this hatred. There are some people who have this kind of hostility, and I have no empirical figures to show how many people are are hostile and how many are not. But people who did have this hostility, instead of helping them overcome this or helping them make peace with this, this whole RSS propaganda machinery fished in this, to use this proverb, that they were fishing in these troubled waters, and they kind of continued to fan it and project Muslims perpetually as an enemy forever. And a historic enemy who was the enemy much before partition through 8th to 9th centuries, starting the 10th century onwards, they became the enemies in retrospect. So this has fueled this both distrust and dislike. Then when the exodus of Kashmiri Pandits happened, it just added to this narrative. The irony is, majority of people who keep talking about Kashmiri Pandits actually do not know any Kashmiri Pandits. They have no exposure to them. They have no experience of what happened in Kashmir or what the situation was in Kashmir when the Pandits left. And a lot of Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits also, you know, it's a divided house. Not all of them are hostile to Muslims. A lot of them, you know, they still have fond memories of their living with their Muslim neighbors.
The bonding is still there, right.
Mm-hmm. It's still like that. So I think this is a very deliberate project. It has really nothing to do with your instincts or your natural thinking. It's a project which has been constructed in a manner to, you know, persuade or misguide people. So I would say that they have been misguided to believe that Muslims are permanently your enemies.
So the new generation that would not have witnessed many of the frightening events, but would have only heard about them, and yet they are forced to carry this burden of kind of always proving that they are secular.
You're talking about Muslims?
Actually, we can talk about both Muslims and Hindus.
See, Muslims, the current generation, people like me, or my nieces, they obviously have no experience of violence. So they have, they don't have the fear or that nervousness that people of my father's generation, and to some extent maybe I don't have the fear, but a lot of people in my generation had seen some.
But even then, you know, many times they are fed on narratives which can stoke some kind of
No, so I'm coming to the current generation. I'm coming to my nieces and my nephew. So what they are facing today is something that I had not faced, and probably my parents also did not face, which is a very vocalized prejudice. So this fuels a very different kind of sentiment. For instance, my niece in her class a few years ago, you know, this 14th August, 15th August, Pakistan Independence Day, India's Independence Day. There was, I think one of them was on the weekend or something. I'm forgetting what the situation was. But the teacher announced that in normal circumstances, they would have celebrated the Independence Day a day early, because it was going to be on a Sunday or something, and the school was going to be shut. So, but the teacher announced in the class that we will not celebrate it on the 14th. We'll celebrate it on the 16th. Or something of that sort. So a boy in my niece's class said, but ma'am, 14th is her Independence Day, implying that she is a Pakistani. So the teacher ignored it and she continued with what she was saying. Later when my niece came home and she narrated this, so I was a bit agitated. I said, you must immediately complain to the teacher, and you should, you know, draw the teacher's attention to anything that you hear. So she said, no, but they always do that. You know, they keep calling me Pakistani. I said, but why are you not complaining about this? So she said, then my friends will also get upset. They'll say, oh, why are you complaining? Because her fear was because she didn't have Muslim friends. All her friends were Hindu girls. So she thought that if she complains against another Hindu person who's not her friend in any case, but she just felt that her friends will feel that, why are you making a big deal about it? What's a big deal? So, you know, this sort of open prejudice I never faced. So my background or my mental makeup has been different from my parents. And this current generation, they have their own baggage or their own burden to carry, which is different.
Yeah, I remember you also mentioned in your book about, I think, a cousin sister of yours, you know, who starts wearing the burqa or...
Yes.
Which...
Her problem is not the prejudice that she faces. Her problem was that there is no sensitivity towards Muslim interests or even festivals. So examination is scheduled on Bakrid, which is the second most important festival in Islam, for Muslims after the Ramzan Eid, which just happened last week. So when the timetable is scheduled or made, or when entrance tests are planned, they don't take into account when the festival would be. It's understandable that they can't figure out when Eid would be, because even Muslims are stupid. They keep going by the sighting of moon instead of just going by the calendar. But Bakrid actually is predetermined. It usually happens on the calendar date, because it's not, it doesn't depend entirely on the sighting of the moon. It coincides with the performance of Hajj. So people know when it is going to be. So dates can be decided well in advance for the Bakrid, but even that doesn't happen. So in schools, a lot of schools now, they have prayers like Gayatri Mantra, and they insist that it is not a Hindu prayer. In fact, a lot of people have told me also that it is not a Hindu prayer. So what is your objection to it? But a lot of Muslims believe that it's a Hindu prayer. And actually, to be honest, I also think it is a Hindu prayer, because if it was not a Hindu prayer, it would have been part of your mainstream schools also, everywhere. But when I was growing up, I never recited this, and nobody I knew recited it. Only my Hindu friends would recite it. Even Sikh friends did not recite it or know it by heart. So obviously, religion has a role to play in this, but now it is being passed off as a non-Hindu prayer, which is an Indian prayer. So why can't you recite it? But a lot of kids do recite it. Even my nieces, they recite it and they know it by heart. But the people who are objecting to this, Muslims who are objecting to this, they find this, that this is an encroachment on their religion. This is an encroachment on their faith.
So when these prejudices, they are persisting, the sense of fear is also not leaving. There's this continuing loss of identity. So then in such a scenario, like, what hope do we give to the youths? Where do we go from here? What is it leading us to?
I'm an extremely optimistic person, and I feel that as long as even one person is like me or optimist about the future, we should not lose hope. So my prescription for moving forward is that we should start talking to one another. We should start asking questions of one another. If we have misgivings about the other person, just ask that person. Maybe Muslims are crooks, and maybe they are liars, and maybe they are pretenders, and they say something about their religion when deep down they believe something else. But at least ask. If you ask, then you can find out this is what a Muslim thinks or feels. Then you can judge, you can verify it with documents or history books or whatever, and you can judge whether the person is lying or not lying. I'll just give you a small example. I have quoted these so many riots, post-partition riots. I had heard about a lot of them colloquially, but when I started researching, I realized everything is available now, and everything is available online. And these are verified statistics, data available on various websites, newspapers, magazines. They have done reports on this. So I have quoted these sources, and I was so amazed that when so much of information is available at a click of a mouse.
So what kind of statistics you're referring to?
No, about when the riot happened, who were the instigators. So all of this is available online. I mean, you just type it and you find old newspaper articles, you find clippings, you find everything. You find Government of India statistics. You go to the Home Ministry website, you find their statistics. You go to their annual reports, you find. So everything is there. It's not that these are matters of conjectures or these are matters of perception. These figures, what action was taken, which committee was formed when, who headed which inquiry committee, what happened to the inquiry committee, everything is available now. And thanks to internet, it's available online. So if you want, you can find accurate or correct information by just you know, doing, running a Google search. So it's not so difficult to find the facts or the truth. So if you are just, if you retain your curiosity, if you just ask a question, if you have misgiving about a person, you can get to the truth. And forget even asking questions. If you have a, let's say, if a Hindu person interacts with a Muslim, has a Muslim friend, he or she will realize that they're actually, they're not like Dracula. They don't have horns on their head, or they are not blood-sucking people. They are regular people. Maybe some of them are extremely conservative. Maybe some of them are radical. Maybe some of them do not like Hindus. And maybe some of them want to stick to their own types. Too bad for them. It's their loss. But at least if you reach out, if you are talking to them, you may just open your own mind.
But do you think that much of this kind of thought process that has taken shape over the years, has been largely, I mean, who we hold responsible? It is like, we always will hear or say that it is a systemic failure of our leadership, political leadership. Then it is this failure of our administration. But if we were to kind of pinpoint, you know, to understand it better and also perhaps resolve these issues faster and more amicably, you know, where would we actually put our finger on?
I have actually put the finger very directly in my book, and I have put the finger on these the Hindu ideologues like Veer Savarkar and Vinayak Savarkar and Golwalkar, Hegewar, you know, people who were the propounders of this theory of Hindu exclusivism. They, because they wanted to create this body of people who could restore their Hindu pride, they had to find an enemy, because unless you have somebody you can target, you can't unite your own people. I mean, you unite against a common enemy. So because they needed a common enemy for this sort of a unity, Muslims appeared to be an easy target, because they were, at that particular point, they were weak, they were largely illiterate, and they had just suffered this huge loss of power after 1857. So they realized that this long history of seven, eight centuries, where the Muslims were the rulers, is very fertile ground to manufacture stories of atrocities, stories of cruelty. And I'm not denying that cruelty wouldn't have happened. But see, if you're talking about 8 centuries long reign, obviously there would be incidents of cruelty. Obviously there would be incident of desecration of temples. There would be lot of things which were not good, or which cannot stand scrutiny in our present times, in our, given our present values of human rights. Obviously, all of that would have happened, because 8th, 9th centuries is a long time. Not all rulers, not all subedars or, you know, administrators or commanders or they would be honorable. So the point is, you have to see things in context. If you are taking some event or something that had happened in the 12th century and you put it to test by today's value system, a constitutional value system, it won't stand scrutiny. So you have to see your history in a context. So I think the blame has to be pinned there, because they took things out of context, exaggerated a lot of things, isolated a lot of incidents which were a consequence of something that had happened at that time, and presented a picture of a large group of people as somebody permanently in hostility with the Hindus.
So you start, you started with this, you know, the strong narrative of your personal story, and where your father kind of suffers this erosion of confidence during the mob attack on your house. And then by the time we reach the end of the book, you're also ending on a positive note with the hope that you see emerging from the Shaheen Bagh protests, because you say that that's the assertion of Muslim rights. And it is kind of a part of a new society, maybe a societal change that is coming about. So what else do you think will be able to bring about, say, a positive change? Good education, better jobs, because all these committee reports that have come, and you've quoted all the statistics, which have actually busted a lot of myths also.
I think Shaheen Bagh has a lot of lessons. The assertion of Muslim rights, or a Muslim asserting her right in India, is one part of it. The other very good thing that that it showed was, though it was started by Muslim women and in many places was led by Muslims, but a lot of non-Muslims had joined hands with Muslims. A lot of the protests when they sprung all across India, it was not Muslim specific protests. There were so many people across age divide, across economic divide, religious divide, who were talking in one voice. And I feel this sort of a pushback has a lot of hope for all of us. It gives you the sense that there is a huge number of Indian population which does not believe in propaganda that has been fed over the years, and which believes that people, individuals, can be good or bad, but you cannot use one or two individuals as a marker for the entire community. So I think this was a very positive development that happened. Everything that you have said, education, employment, all of this will help in mainstreaming of Muslims. And if Muslims are in the, if there are more Muslims in the mainstream, you will get to see them more. And you'll probably will not, get to that stage and when suddenly you see a Muslim and you say, oh, but you don't look like a Muslim. Or suddenly you see a Muslim and you say, oh, just fits the stereotype of a burqa or a hijab or whatever. So if there are more, and this is nothing new, in our Indian small towns, I don't know where you grew up, but in Indian small towns, Muslims and Hindus, they have coexisted for centuries. It was very natural to see a Muslim woman in a burqa moving around and nobody would give a second glance. Just as it was very natural to see a Hindu woman, with sindoor and bindi and sometimes with a ghungad. So these have been part of our small town landscape for such a long time that when this division, or suddenly, you using these stereotypes to mark out a community, it cannot be a natural thing. It has to be an artificial thing, because this has been part of our society for years and years. The sight of a Muslim man, a bearded man with a skull cap and a henna beard, it has been part of our society for
I was about to say that. Yeah, I was about to say that. Like, there was a time when I think both the communities, the Hindus and the Muslims, they really existed, coexisted very beautifully in harmony. But, that same acceptance is now missing.
Yes, because there's so much of vilification has happened now. Now, people actually, because you have drilled this in their heads so much, they fear an ordinary Muslim. I mean, I have come across very nice, amicable Hindu people who say that they're scared. When they see a Muslim person, a Muslim man, they feel some sort of a fear that, is he a terrorist? Now, this cannot be a natural thing that has happened. No, it has to be something which has been tutored, which has been put in your head artificially. Because
it's like the coronavirus.
Yeah. Now you see this Tablighi Jamaat incident, which happened last year. Now, why would a normal human being behave in the manner that the media was showing? Why would a person who is COVID positive in an isolation ward suddenly flash himself at a nurse? Why would he do that? I mean, if you have sense, if you are, you know, if you are, I don't know what word to use, but any average person would know that this cannot be true. This is fake news. But not only people believed it, they actually went ahead and started abusing them. You know, stories that a Muslim vegetable vendor, he's spitting on his vegetables and selling. Why would he do that? I mean, he wants to make a living. He's coming to sell his vegetables. Why would he do something like this, spit on the vegetable and sell? So videos were circulated and then people said, no, we'll boycott the Muslim vegetable vendors. We will not allow them. So these are the kind of things. Take this whole, the cow business, the cow slaughter thing. Now, cow slaughter has been banned in large part of India and it is nothing new. It has been banned for, you know, by law, it has been banned, I think post-independence, many states had restrictions on cow slaughter. But now with all this lynching happening, why would a Muslim man still slaughter a cow and carry the cow meat with him? I mean, he has to be completely crazy to do something like this, imperil his life in this manner.
So in such a vitiated atmosphere, like really, I really want to go back from where will our hope stem? You know, like where does the... I'm more particularly focused on the new generation, the younger generation. Where does that young Muslim adult stand today?
I think from the Muslims' perspective, they have to really focus on getting the right kind of education. One of the problems with Muslims and education is that a lot of them, they don't know what kind of education they need to actually get sensible jobs. You know, the entire employment sector has changed now. So a lot of Muslims, they still do not understand that just doing your BA or history honors or, you know, BCom honors will not get you a sensible or appropriate job that you think you should get because of all these years of education. Because this education really has no place in today's, and in the next 5 years, it will really have no place in the job market. There are no jobs which a person with just an ordinary BCom or a MCom or a course like BBA can get. I mean, what kind of a job will a BBA person get? A person with Bachelor's of Business Administration get? So a lot of Muslims are still doing these sort of, those who have access to higher education. Even they are sticking to these kind of traditional courses. But this itself is a minority. The majority really doesn't have access to higher education. They are school dropouts, 10th dropout, 12th dropout. So they get into these technical courses, IITI type courses, mechanics and repair work and all that. So this is the biggest challenge. Unless they get into the education which gives them proper jobs or jobs which satisfies their aspirations, they will not be the part of the mainstream. They cannot join the mainstream, which because the mainstream employment industry is moving really rapidly in a very different direction. So these people will always be left behind. This will fuel more frustration because they feel that we have spent so many years studying, spent so much money on our education, and we are still not getting the jobs. This also fuels a sense of victimization. They feel that, oh, I'm being discriminated against. But the truth is, when they are not getting the appropriate job, they are not being discriminated. They just do not have the adequate qualification for that particular job or whatever they're looking for. So I think education is the biggest challenge, and it has to start with really good quality schools and like mainstream schools. the public schools, they have career counseling. They start very early. They start with class 8 onwards. They start advising the children that what is, what will get you, what sort of employment or what careers you can look at. I sort of think this sort of counseling should start in the schools which a lot of Muslims have access to. So whether they are schools in Muslim-dominated areas or whether they are schools where a large number of Muslim students go, so at least they are better advised to the kind of education they should pursue, the higher education they should pursue. And once they reach this stage, then higher education should be made easy for them, because not everybody can get into the government subsidized universities. Even regular people, non-Muslims do not get there. So they have to get into the private universities, which we have so many now. And a lot of them are very good, but they're exorbitantly, I would say, priced. The fee structure is such, the fee structure is such that a lot of Muslims cannot afford it.
So, I think we also, I mean, would you agree, like, if I say that there also has to be a much larger public engagement, and not only from the Muslim community, from also the non-Muslim communities, to kind of, you know, understand and help Islam evolve in India. I do not know, like, how Islam evolves in India, how Islam evolves in the rest of the world.
You mean evolve? When you're talking of evolve, you're talking of future, or you're talking
future?
Of the past?
No, I'm talking of future.
See, as a religion, world over, religions are taking a bit of a backseat, except for a few developing countries, and India being one of them, where the younger generation is as religious as their parents were. But worldwide, the younger generation is slightly more laid back towards religion as compared to their previous generation. Maybe this is going to be our future as well, going forward, that people would become a little more, they'll step back from a very ritualized religion which dictates every minute of your life. Maybe something like that will happen. And if that happens, I think that would be the greatest unifying force, because if everybody steps back from their religious practice dogmas, then they can find, you know, new meeting grounds, new grounds of engagement with one another, which could be either economics or it could be, you know, social sciences or whatever. So I think the evolution of Islam in India will also depend upon the evolution of other religions in India. If everybody else continues to cling to their faith, and our public spaces continue to remain as religious as they are today, where, you know, even sensible people are talking about the benefits of cow urine and benefits of cow dung and as a treatment for COVID. So if this sort of a religiosity continues to invade our public spaces, then the Muslims will also be, you know, they're part of the society. So they will also be clinging on to their dogmas and clinging on to their superstitions and age-old practices.
Yeah, but I do see the point, because I feel that, you know, no matter like how much distance you cover in life in terms of your education, in terms of money, in terms of your status, in terms of privilege, but if you are always kind of bracketed, then if you're always judged, then of course it will continue to have a very devastating impact on society, right?
Yes, because if you're constantly judged, then you're constantly on trial. And that's not a good feeling.
So I even while reading your book, I was thinking, like, how in this whole culture of Islamophobia, the mind keeps going back to the same point, you know, what gives you hope and how you give hope to others.
as I mentioned, what gives me hope is this last 2 years that I have seen a pushback by young Muslims in not only trying to strike a conversation with non-Muslim people, whether it's on social media, whether it's on Twitter, you know, all these hashtags, we started talk to a Muslim or Muslim are not terrorists or whatever. So this outreach, I think, is very good. And I think it has had some sort of an impact on at least some people, whoever they were able to reach out to. There is some conversation happening, and at least I see it on my timeline, despite some amount of hatred as well. But this is a good thing, which gives me hope. And plus the fact that so many people who are not Muslims, they are not, you know, they are not victim of propaganda. They have the ability to see through propaganda. And this can be seen by the reaction that my book has got, the reviews that I have got, and reviews written by non-Muslim people who have found the book not only interesting, but also something which has helped them probably understand Islam better and understand Muslims better. So I think that that's a very good thing, and that's something which I draw a lot of hope from and a lot of comfort from.
Yeah. So on that positive note, that like, as you said, the conversations should continue. So we will call it a wrap, Ghazala. And I really thank you for joining us in this conversation for the Hindu podcast, and my best wishes to you for your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.